al. versus Gordon Hall. Sure, I'm right. 10 minutes, Roberta Howell, representing Dr. Hall.
10 minutes.
Mark E. Larson, representing the Plaintiff's Compensation Fund. 20 minutes. 15 minutes, J. Michael Ann, representing
10 minutes.
Jerome A. Hirschman, representing 5 minutes, Stephen Sager, which is a response. 5 minutes for Mark Larson, a rebuttal, and 5 minutes for J. Michael Ann, rebuttal. We'll see how it goes. Okay. Ms. Howell, Attorney Howell.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Counsel, it would be good to tell us what you represent, Dr. Hall, what issues you're going to
absolutely
address.
May it please the Court, as Justice Abrahamson has noted, my name is Roberta Howell of the law firm of Foley & Lardner. I represent Dr. Hall and the Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin on the appeal. There are two issues raised by the appeal before the Court this morning. First, the constitutionality of the cap on the recovery for loss of society and companionship in wrongful death actions under 895.04, and two, whether a medical malpractice plaintiff may add together the recovery allowed under that cap with the recovery allowed under the cap for non-economic damages under 893.55 to increase the total recovery available. On behalf of all the appellants, I will address the first issue, the constitutional one. Following that, Mr. Larson, counsel for the Patients' Compensation Fund, will then address the issue of combining the two caps to increase the total recovery. Turning then to the constitutional argument, the trial court in this matter found that the cap on recovery for the loss of society and companionship in a wrongful death case is unconstitutional. The Morins in this case advanced three arguments to defend that position on appeal. In our briefs, we explain in detail why each of the arguments raised by the Morins, as well as the rationale relied upon by the trial court, but not defended by the Morins in this court, should be rejected and the trial court's judgment reversed. Now, what that material in our brief shows is that while the precise question before the court this morning on the constitutionality of the caps has not been addressed before, the answer to that question follows inescapably from well-settled, long-standing decisions of this court. In fact, if the trial court were correct in finding that the cap were unconstitutional, over 100 years of case law from this court would be overruled expressly or by implication.
That's the case law dealing with the common law versus the statutory.
That's correct.
Because we have case law about caps, too, but not directly on point.
Directly, correct. And in fact, however, though, the recent decisions of this court on the caps, on the retroactivity of the retroactive increase in the caps, for example, In many respects, those decisions would be nullified as well if the court were correct, because there would have been no balancing that needed to be done in those cases. In addition, based on the well-settled law surrounding wrongful death actions, this court has used that law by analogy or example in perhaps dozens of cases over the years to reach a result, and that law would also be called into question. The principle of stare decisis, adherence to precedent, ensures that well-settled law is not abandoned lightly. This court has held that existing law should not be open to revision in every case, lest deciding cases becomes a mere exercise in judicial will with arbitrary and unpredictable results.
Ms. Howell, what was the reasoning of the trial court in finding the caps unconstitutional?
The trial court had several rationales. The trial court found that the cap violated the right to a certain remedy under the Constitution. It found that it violated the right to trial by jury, and it found that it violated due process and equal protection guarantees under the Wisconsin Constitution.
And you're taking issue with all of those arguments,
with each
is that
of
correct?
Those. That's correct. Although in the briefing in this court, only three arguments are actually raised to defend the trial court's decision. One is the separation of powers, which the trial court did not rely on. Two is the right to trial by jury. And three is the equal protection argument.
Thank you.
Counselor,
well,
would we have to conclude that there was not only a common law claim for wrongful death, but ignore the statutory cap set by the statutory claim in order to come up with the conclusion that the trial court reached?
That's correct, Justice Rogenczak. In fact, this court would have to essentially abandon not only what this court has held for 100 years, that there was in fact no common law cause of action for wrongful death, but what courts across the country have in fact found. And as well as in England, where the common law came from. And until Lord Campbell's Act, and I believe it was 1850-something, adopted a wrongful death action in that country, the common law courts in England did not recognize the right of action for wrongful death at common law either. And in addition to finding that there would be a wrongful death action available at common law and ignoring the statutory caps, this court would also have to ignore the express provision of the Constitution, Article 14, Section 13, which says that the Wisconsin legislature has the right to limit, suspend, or even eliminate altogether a common law right of action, or any right of action for that matter. So in other words, not only 100 years of decisions by this court and courts across the nation would have to be overruled, but the specific constitutional prerogatives of the legislature set out in Article 14, Section 13 would also have to be rejected.
Does that provision say that the legislature can change the right to jury trial?
It does not. But because there was no right to jury, because there is no right to a jury trial in an action that does not exist at common law, the legislature's abandoning an action at common law or even eliminating an action such as this one is not implicated in the first instance. And if, in fact, the legislature has the right to eliminate an action entirely, then the right to jury trial is not implicated.
Well, the state of Washington was faced with something similar, and it took the position that just damages are a jury question at common law. This is a damage issue, and that you can't take away the right to jury trial, therefore the cap is wrong.
But, in fact, the Wisconsin Constitution specifically says that the legislature can eliminate a common law cause of action, and that would include damages. And, therefore, the Wisconsin Constitution provides that the legislature can, in fact, eliminate the cause of action entirely. I frankly can't tell you what the Washington Constitution says in that regard, but the Wisconsin Constitution is very clear in Article 14, Section 13. And this court's recent decision in Aker versus the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, this court expressly noted that that provision, which incorporates the common law until altered or suspended by the legislature, that confers on the legislature the power to define and limit causes of action or even abrogate them altogether on policy grounds. And that's, in fact, what the court has done, or the legislature has done in this instance in putting a cap on the recovery. Now, perhaps recognizing the implications of this well-settled law on their defense of the trial court's decision, the Moorens begin their argument with this historical analysis that attempts to show the court that it's been wrong for 100 years when it says that there was no action for wrongful death at common law. As we explain in the briefs in some detail, it's not the court's decisions that were wrong, it's the Moorens' historical analysis. While there was this system in ancient England that might be considered analogous to a wrongful death action, the system of wargeld, it no longer existed by 1776 when the common law, the date that's important for the adoption of common law into Wisconsin. More important, and ironically, even that system of wargeld only allowed a specified amount of damages, put a cap on the damages that could be recovered based on the deceased individual's rank in the community. So even under the historical system proposed by the Moorens, there was still a cap on the damages that were recoverable. What then does that mean for the issue before the court this morning? What that means is that there's no reason for this court to depart from its 100 years of case law, most recently noted in the Nieman versus American National Property and Casualty decision, that wrongful death actions are a creature of the legislature, and both the damages recoverable and the amount recoverable are limited to what is set forth in the statute. Two, it means that there's no reason to revisit the court's longstanding recognition of the legislature's prerogatives under Article 14, Section 13, most recently noted in its Acre decision, that the legislature has the right to limit, suspend, or even eliminate a cause of action. And it also means that there's no reason for this court to revisit its holding in Wangen versus Ford Motor Company, where the court noted the rationale that underlies this statute and the reason for the caps in this statute. In that decision, the court noted that the legislature has traditionally limited both the elements recoverable in a wrongful death action as well as the amounts recoverable in a wrongful death action, because the legislature has feared the passions that run high in a death case and the potential for huge damage awards, which could in turn damage the court, the whole system of justice, and the reputation of the judicial system in the community.
I just want to ask a question. The legislature has set caps in the wrongful death, or we know that, but is that any different? I was thinking that we have the workman's compensation. We have caps in that. Is that any different than the wrongful death caps? Are they the same? Is there a problem?
I think for constitutional purposes, they are the same. The wrongful death statute, which this court has recognized as somewhat analogous, for example, to the medical malpractice concept, which is really what we're dealing with in some respects in this case. This is a medical malpractice action. The court has recognized that the legislature has the prerogative to look at a body of law and on policy grounds determine that there needs to be a revision, that there need to be caps in place, there need to be different procedures that are applied, et cetera. And that's, in fact, what they've done in the wrongful death context. I mean, the wrongful death statute was adopted shortly after Wisconsin became a state, but not until 1931 did that statute allow for the recovery of loss of society and companionship. So regardless of, even if the right itself, an action for wrongful death existed at common law, this particular type of recovery, which is at issue in this case, simply didn't exist in Wisconsin until 1931.
I think workman's comp caps have been around since the 1913, 1914.
Exactly, approximately the same period in history. That's correct, and they have been routinely upheld.
Yes, but the whole point about workers' comp is you took away something and you gave something. Here, you're just taking away damages, but what are you giving them?
Well, sorry, I'm out of time. I'll answer the question before I sit down. In this court's decision in Strakowski, that specific question was raised, whether they essentially need to give a quid pro quo in order for the legislature to exercise its constitutional prerogative. And this court said that's simply not necessary. The legislature has the constitutional right to limit, suspend, or eliminate altogether the cause of action.
Chief, may I ask
that? How does the Martin balancing test come into play then with regard to weighing the rights of the public with regard to the remedies and the rights of the individual?
Well, I think in one respect it does come into play, in one respect it doesn't. It does come into play in the sense that if the cap is unconstitutional in the first instance, there's nothing to weigh. It doesn't come into play because that balancing test applies when the legislature retroactively changes a remedy, and that's not what we have here. There's been no change in the remedy at all. So in that sense, the balancing test doesn't apply at all.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Larson.
May it please the court. The issue that I'm going to address is the issue of the relationship between the two damage caps within that discuss non-economic damages in 893.55 sub 4. The cap that set forth at D that is indicated to be the total non-economic cap, and then sub F, which incorporates the dollar amount of the wrongful death limit on loss of society and companionship, set forth in 895.04 sub 4. This issue was not addressed by the trial court, but it is an important issue for this court to decide because, as the other decisions have affected this particular case, it is of importance to be decided for this particular case, but it is also of statewide importance. I tried a case in this very courtroom last week where we returned a verdict that rendered the issue moot. However, in the pretrial negotiations leading up to that, that is one of the huge barriers, is the plaintiffs claiming that there are two caps that get added together, and we talk about there being one cap fitting within the other cap. At the same time I was trying my case, there was a case in Kenosha in which the verdict that returned clearly is going to require this case to be decided. The non-economic damages were in excess of both the non-economic cap and the wrongful death cap. Those were both medical malpractice wrongful death cases that were tried just in the last week. And it's my understanding from my client, the Patients' Compensation Fund, that there is at least a dozen cases out there where this issue is impeding the ability to discuss any sort of resolution of those cases short of trial. One point I want to make at the very beginning that I don't believe we got an opportunity to fully discuss in the reply briefs is the plaintiffs make an issue that sub F was created in part because the legislature needed to do that because there are the two types of case claims recognized by Wangen. There is the estate's claim for conscious pain and suffering prior to death, and also the parent's claim for loss of sight and companionship flowing from the death. Now, in reality, that same dichotomy exists in bodily injury cases. Rather than the estate, this child who would be seriously injured has their own claim for pain and suffering. In addition, they would have the claim for disability and loss of enjoyment of life for as long as that serious injury would impact them. The parents would also have a claim for loss of sight and companionship for that seriously injured child as well. And everyone would concede that the single non-economic cap applies in that case. So there isn't the need for this separate cap to be created in order for it to be compensation in that situation at all for those two types of claims.
Now, the loss of society maximum, if we were under the new law, is $500,000.
Under the new law for a minor would be $500,000, correct. That does not apply in this case.
I understand that, although part of that has been reserved, but I understand that. The maximum cap for MedNow is how much?
Currently, the non-economic cap is $422,000 and I believe $632.
Okay, that's the $350,000 plus index for inflation.
Right.
Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yes.
So let's just say it's $420,000. That means, and if you don't want to stack those, that means the max is 422, which is less than the max allowed by law for society and community.
I would actually concede that that's not correct, Your Honor, that our position is by using the word notwithstanding, and our position is the plain language of the statute supply.
Let me just double back. Your position, 422,000 is the max everybody can get?
Except in a death case, we would concede that in the event of a minor child under the law currently, by virtue of the language notwithstanding, the $500,000 cap would apply in that case.
Okay. So $500,000 is the max.
For a minor currently.
Okay. You're going to take whichever is the largest max.
In a death case, here, I would agree with that.
All right. Okay. Tell us how you get there.
Well, the plain language, when you look at the statutes, Your Honor, and there was one other point that I wanted to make beforehand, is the legislature, if the plaintiff's argument is correct, that sub F was necessary for the legislature to create this separate cap that was in addition to the non-economic cap set forth in sub D, one of the problems with that logic would be, first of all, it's inconsistent with the Reinick decision. It's not following what the Reinick decision told the legislature how to correct the situation if that's what the legislature intended. And the other impact is, if the legislature tomorrow repealed sub F, under the plaintiff's analysis of the statute, they would be left without a remedy for loss of society and companionship in a wrongful death case. Because they're saying they're two separate caps, and if the legislature chose to repeal the one, there wouldn't be any remedy anymore. Our position is what would happen in that situation is we'd be back to the Reinick situation before, and that is the total non-economic cap would be the cap that would apply even in a wrongful death case if sub F was somehow repealed subsequently. The plain language under sub A is the one that defines what is included in the definition of non-economic. It includes pain and suffering, includes loss of sight and companionship, and also uses other synonyms for similar types of claims. Sub B states that the cap set forth in sub D is the total non-economic damage limit for each occurrence resulting in bodily injury or death. And the death language in there was the one that this court focused on in Reinick in coming to its conclusion that the non-economic cap in sub D did in fact apply to wrongful death claims, including the loss of sight and companionship. It's important to note that the legislature, when it resurrected the maximum total non-economic damage limit in Act 10, 1995, it left alone the language that this court relied on in the Reinick decision in sub A, sub B, and sub D. The only thing they altered was the dollar amount and the effective date of application of that particular dollar amount. They did not
change.
Could
I interrupt you just a minute? Just say that the medical malpractice involved the birth of twins, and both the twins were damaged at birth. Would there be two claims, one on behalf of each twin and each claim subject to a separate cap, or do you combine the claims of the twins for one cap?
I don't believe that's it's actually an answer that's found in the statute. I believe the answer to that is found in the case law of this court from years ago in the Wissom case and in the Cagill case, and that is that's a fact-sensitive determination driven by the view of a layperson. Would they consider that one single unit or occurrence or not? And I'm reluctant to make a determination on that because that is a fact decision that really doesn't flow from these particular statutes. These statutes mimic the wrongful death statute in that they say this limit applies per occurrence.
Right.
And
when I look
an occurrence
at our,
has to be therefore defined, and that may take a factual determination to do
okay.
that.
Well, I look at our opinion in Wangen versus Ford Motors, where we said that the estate's action for wrongful injury to the person and the wrongful death belong to the named beneficiaries for their pecuniary loss. The latter action begins where the former ends. It is not a double recovery, but a recovery for a double wrong. And don't you think that ought to enter our calculations about whether or not we look at this as two separate wrongs or torts, and therefore there can be separate and determinable damages rather than one separate wrong, is kind of how you're analyzing.
Well, the hypothetical you gave me was that there were two separate people suffering bodily injuries or
that's
death.
That's right, I did, and to me that's somewhat analogous to the language that we have here.
Well,
it's clearer to see because you have separate and independent individuals, and I just want you to respond to why I'm wrong about that.
All right. In this case, no one has contested that there is more than, that no one's asserted that there is more than one occurrence, and I think a layperson looking at this would see that there was a misdiagnosis, injury, and resulting death from the child, and that all flowed as one occurrence.
Well, that's why I gave you the birth of twins. They both got born, and what caused the problem was the same lack of care by the physician, but you have two individuals, so the separateness of their claims, I think, are perhaps a little easier to identify. But when I look at that, I also think of our language in Wangen versus Ford Motors, and I wanted you to respond to why I was wrong. Why was that a bad analogy for me to pick up?
It's not necessarily a bad analogy, but it's an analogy that I'm saying is the answer to that lies not in the statutes, just like it doesn't lie in the wrongful death statute. Because the wrongful death statute of 895.04 sub 4 uses the very same language that there is a single cap per occurrence, and that flows with this. Now, Wangen did not discuss that there were multiple caps to be applied in that situation because of how it was laid out. The idea, and I'm on stop
right.
here, the idea would be that it would have to be a determination, is there more than one cause of action in that case, in the strict sense of would a layperson view that as two separate instances or not. Now, if you're talking about the death of both infants, it may well be viewed by a layperson as one single occurrence, and then there would be only one single cap. Now, if there's other extenuating circumstances, that there were different acts involved with resuscitating one twin versus the other twin, then you might well have a layperson looking at that and saying, no, these are two separate occurrences. But again, that doesn't flow from an interpretation of these statutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We have attorney J. Michael N. representing plaintiffs here.
Okay. May it please the court. My name is Michael N.
along with my partner, Jerome Hirschman, we are going to be representing the Morin family in this case. We've divided the topics we're going to talk about. I'm going to talk about, first, the subject Mr. Larson was just talking about, the legislative intent in Law 1995, Wisconsin Act 10. The second topic I'm going to talk about is whether Judge Waddick was correct in reducing the damage award for the pain and suffering of Shay Morin from $550,000 to $100,000. I have 15 minutes. I'm going to try to break it up about as evenly as I can on those two topics. In regard to the intent of the legislature, and that's what we have to determine, I just want to quickly go through the history of medical malpractice damages. The law was begun in 1975, and there were no caps on damages whatsoever, so that in a case such as this, the Morin case, up until 1986, June 14th of 1986, there would be unlimited recovery, depending upon what the verdict was, for the pain and suffering of Shay Morin. There would be no cap on the recovery for the parents for the loss of society claim. And that was shown by the court in both the Reinick decision and the Jelinek decision. The legislature then changed things, effective July of 1986, and said, we're now going to have one cap that covers the whole gamut. And in the Reinick decision, you correctly decided that that was the fact. The distinction, though, is that when Reinick was decided, here is what the law was, and I'm reading from the Reinick decision. You said, you cited section 655.017 and said, the amount of non-economic damages recoverable by a claimant or plaintiff under this chapter is subject to the limit, singular, under section 893.554. And at that time, there was one limit, and that limit was $1 million. That law existed until January 1st, 1991, when it went out of business. It was a sunset provision. So from January 1st, 1991, until 1995, Wisconsin Act 10, again, there were no caps. So in this case, the estate would be recovered to full compensation. The parents would be entitled to full compensation without a cap. The law was passed, and the first and most important thing in the law, in my opinion, is that instead of saying the limit, you know, these damages are subject to the limit, it now says the limits, plural, under section 893.554D and F.
That's under 655.017. That's the last words in those that statute.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Then, nothing else has changed other than the amount, so that instead of the old $1 million back in those days, it's now $350,000. Except the new law is subsection F was created. And subsection F says, notwithstanding the limits on non-economic damages under this subsection, damages recoverable for wrongful death are subject to the limit under 895.044. So clearly, in my view, the legislature has now said, we have two separate caps available for people who are injured in a situation such as we are in today in this case. I think it's very important that when the legislature was talking about non-economic damages, including in subsection D, they used that term, non-economic, but when they created subsection F, the legislature did not use that term, non-economic damages.
Mr. Ann, your opposing counsel indicated that he was relying on the plain meaning of 4F. Now, you seem to be saying the same thing, but obviously interpreting it differently. Is that correct?
I think their position is that
4F is considered to be a non-economic damage. They're saying there's only one cap that encompasses both. I'm saying in 4F it does not say this is a non-economic damage. This says, in addition, notwithstanding the non-economic damage part of it, in F, you get the damages recoverable under the wrongful death statute.
So both of you are saying this is not ambiguous. You just disagree as to the plain meaning.
Well, I believe that they're saying it's not ambiguous, but as Chief Justice Abrahamson correctly noted, when I was reading their first brief, they say in their first brief, here the language of 893.55.4a, b, and d make it absolutely clear and undisputable that the non-economic cap contained in 893.55.4d sets the, quote, total non-economic damages that can be recovered for a medical malpractice claim, regardless of whether the resulting harm or injury is injury or death. They're saying D sets the cap. Well, then in our brief, we said, but what about the $500,000? So they came back in their second brief and said, no, we didn't really mean that. We meant that the notwithstanding means you take the higher of the two. I don't think that, you know, in my view, this is clearly the legislature putting a separate and distinct cap for a separate and distinct cause of action.
Okay.
That is additive.
893.55.4a, b, c, d deal with Med-Mal, whether it's a death case or not a death case. Is that right?
That is correct.
F deals with Med-Mal because it deals with health care providers, right? And incorporates into F for health care providers the limits set forth in 895.044.
That's
how you read that.
Absolutely. And
you read it with the and from 655.017.
Absolutely. And another point that I don't want to beat a dead horse to death here, but
it's still living.
Good. when we look at subsections C and F of that 893.55 sub 4, both of them tell the court what to do in regard to contributory negligence and how to bring cases back to the cap. And the statutes both say, for each of them, the court shall award as non-economic damages the lesser of the reduced amount or the limit. That's reading from C. And then when you go to the wrongful death part, it says, the court shall award the lesser of the reduced amount or the limit under 895.04. It seems to me that that is clearly saying, in a case such as this, you look at one cause of action, the loss of society and companionship, you set that, bring it back to the cap if you have to. You look at the pain and suffering, you bring that back to the cap if you have to. But there's nothing at all in the language that would suggest that you're somehow are capped with a total universal cap. So one last point.
You think the legislative history, if I understand your brief, supports your reading?
Absolutely. And I would just remind the court that in the Chapinski case that you decided in 2000, the issue was the same statute, the same act, and whether adult children could recover. And the court in that case, three times you said, and I'm reading from the decision, had the legislature wanted to incorporate Section 895.042 into Chapter 655 and medical malpractice actions, it would have been referred to or included in 893.55. Then later on you say, have the legislature wanted also to incorporate the class of claimants entitled to recover, they could have easily done so by changing the statute. Later on you said, again, have the legislature been attempting to incorporate the wrongful death class of claimants to medical malpractice, they could have used terminology such as, I'm suggesting to you that had the legislature really intended what the defendants are saying, they would have done it. They would have said in their legislation, there's really only one universal cap here, and you have to somehow merge them. Let me go on to my other topic, and that is whether Judge Waddick should have reduced the damages for pain and suffering from $550,000 to $100,000. The defendants have suggested that we don't have a right to do that because this appeal by them did not ask for anything regarding damages. We cited in our brief the Plesko versus City of Milwaukee decision, and decision after decision after decision upholding that says that when the opposing party appeals, that we have the right to argue that the remittitor was improper. And I will address that later if they stick to that issue. In a case such as this, and I just want to refer to the case of Jones versus Fisher. It's a 1969 Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. The court said, the problem of achieving fairness in assessing damages for personal injury is fraught with difficulty. Theoretical nicety is impossible. Under our judicial system, we rely primarily upon the good sense of jurors to determine the amount of money that will compensate an individual for whatever loss of well-being he has suffered as a result of injury. And I won't read this whole quote, but what the court is saying and what you have always said in my reading of these cases is that the determination of damages in an injury claim, there's no formula for it. It depends upon what the 12 individuals who sat as jurors in the case determined to be fair compensation. And the law is, all the court can do is to see that the jury approximates a sane estimate, or as it has sometimes been said, see that the results attained do not shock the judicial conscience.
Mr. N, when the trial judge cut the amount from $550,000 to $100,000, did he give any reasons for doing so? Did he explain what he was doing and why?
Here's what the court said, Your Honor. We have this in our brief at pages 30 to 32. He says, a court should not disturb the judgment of the jury unless it is clearly apparent that they went beyond some point. What is that point? It is not written in books. It is written nowhere except in discretion and judgment. He then says, I often wondered if one were to be asked whether a lawyer or judge beforehand, where is that point? Because we know that there is a point in every case. Where is that point? Sometimes we don't know, none of us, but we know it's there. And he went on with this meandering about, gee, there's got to be a point, and I think that this is too high, is eventually what he ended up saying. And the law is that a trial court deserves to have you give credence to what his rationale and his decision is if he has clearly stated on the record the reason for his decision. And in this particular case, about the only thing he said is, well, it was a short period of time. And what I did on our motions after verdict is I gave the court, Judge Waddick, I said, here are cases that I just picked up of other verdicts with very short periods of time. I gave him a case of $600,000 for 45 minutes of pain and suffering, $500,000 for somebody who drowned, $1 million for 15 minutes of pain and suffering following an auto accident, $1 million for several minutes after being struck by a bus, $750,000 for 14 minutes when a plane was going down. And I didn't do that to say these are correct, but what I did that for is to say this is a jury issue. And when I argued this case to the jury, I said to the jurors, members of the jury, this is your decision. And you go back, use your common sense, and render a fair verdict. And I believe that's what they did.
Am I correct that this little girl was ill for about 3 days before she died?
The testimony, Your Honor, and I'm afraid I didn't have time to go into this, but the testimony is that she was starving. The doctors who came in described this process where everything that she takes in is going out of her system through her urine. She is literally starving to death. She's becoming acidotic. It's creating pain in her abdomen. She's vomiting to try to get rid of the acid. I mean, there was testimony, in my view, up the wazoo as to what this poor little girl was going through. And, you know, I think the jury was well informed and they made a good decision.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hersman?
May it please the court, my name is Jerome Hersman, and I also represent the Morins, and I'm going to spend my time discussing the constitutionality of the wrongful death statute and the caps on damages associated with that statute. When confronted with the propriety of some aspect of a wrongful death statute, most courts have simply accepted the premise that there was no common law right to a recovery in wrongful death that would compete with the existing framework of that state's legislation. And we submit that isn't the case. And courts have begun to recognize, not all, some courts have rejected the premise, but courts have recognized that a claim for wrongful death existed at common law, and therefore claims, such claims, are entitled to traditional constitutional protection and interpretation. Our analysis of the wrongful death statute occurs at two levels. First, was there a right to recovery at common law? If yes, then do the limits imposed by the legislature pass constitutional muster? The lines cannot be blurred. We recognize, as Ms. Hull pointed out, the legislature has the ability to limit or eliminate a common law cause of action, and that is what this court indicated in the Aker decision. But if this action existed at common law, then the legislature needs to clearly express the intent to change the common law.
Won't we have to overrule a lot of our cases in order to agree with you, Counselor?
Yes, you will.
And why should we do that?
You're going to have to abandon approximately 150 years of precedent.
Well, on what issue? That this is a statutory versus a common law?
That this is a statutory issue.
But is there any case we'd have to overrule on constitutionality, assuming that we agree with you on the common law issue?
I don't think there is.
Okay, so you're saying we'd have to withdraw language saying wrongful death is statutory, not common law.
That's precisely correct. And we're not asking the court to casually abandon the premise that this was an action that was statutorily created. And we recognize, however, that stare decisis is, as this court has stated, not an inexorable command. Last year in Johnson Controls versus Employers, this court set forth the criterion for changing longstanding precedent.
I thought you were going to quote the words inscribed in the stone at the entrance to the Racine Courthouse, which says, and I don't have it quite right, but it's close, law must be stable, but must grow.
And that's the...
You accept that?
I accept that. Okay. And that is the genius of the common law, is that it changes to society's needs. And standing before you now, I'm asking this court to revisit and not casually look away from Justice Harlan's decision in the Moran case and a number of other circuit court or state court decisions which accept the fact that common law rights of action existed with respect to wrongful death and the recovery of damages. And if we look at the criterion in Johnson Controls, I think the bottom line is this court should balance the question of whether we blindly accept the fact or accept the proposition that wrongful death is a statutorily created creature, and balance that against the constitutional protections that the state's citizens are entitled to.
Let me tell you my problem. Suppose I agree with that. And suppose I therefore say at common law you have a right to damages on death, and you overcome that. We have cases that accept caps on Med-Mal. That was a common law personal injury, and we've accepted caps on that. We have accepted caps on governmental governmental liability. $25,000 increased to $50,000. So if you get hit by a government employee or get damaged that way, you get limited damages. If you get hit or injured by somebody else, you get whatever the damages are in your case. How can we distinguish this from the prior cases in which this court has accepted caps?
The way this court may distinguish the wrongful death caps from the previous decisions that you commented on, Madam Chief Justice, is that those decisions underwent constitutional scrutiny. Wrongful death damage caps are entitled to that same analysis. It's never happened before. And so if we go through the analysis, we need to know the legislative justification for a cap on wrongful death damages, and I don't believe one has ever been stated.
Well, why don't you state it?
I believe they did state that they were balancing in the arguments let's say in the wrongful death. Is still made.
That is being made in the medical malpractice context, and that is the primary rationale cited by Judge Fine in the Guzman decision. Right. And we question the wisdom of that decision. We do not concede that Judge Fine was correct in his assessment of the crisis which exists in the medical negligence arena. This court has an arm in the director of state courts, and statistics are freely available to this court showing that the extremely limited number of medical negligence cases being pursued. And so I believe that, however, in looking at the municipal limits, looking at the medical malpractice limits, that debate occurred in the legislature, and there was a rationale set forth. When the caps on damages and wrongful death were set, it was under the premise that we're creating a cause of action, something that never existed before. When the original caps were in place in 1857, there was no such thing as tort reform. There was no insurance crisis. And the legislature picked $5,000 at that point as an amount to recover. Over the last 150 years, those caps have been arbitrarily increased without specific rationale. The numbers selected during the course of my 16-year legal career have changed from 25 to 50 to 150 to 350 or 500. And after very little change in the decades before that. There is no specific rationale that has been stated by the legislature, and this court hasn't had the opportunity to assess the legislature's ability and right to modify, alter, or eliminate this common law right of action.
Does the legislature have to state a
Go ahead, Justice.
Well, following up on that, does the legislature have to state a rationale? Isn't this statute presumed to be constitutional?
There is a presumption of constitutionality. However, the statute does not change the common law unless the legislative purpose to do so is clearly expressed in the language of the statute. That's from Fuchsgruber versus Custom Accessories. I think that the legislature needs to highlight for this court its rationale. If something is being taken away from the citizens of the state of Wisconsin, the legislature needs to tell us why.
It doesn't need to enter into any findings or take testimony about its reasons for enacting a statute, though. This is not the Congress. This is a state legislature with plenary legislative power. And so all Fuchsgruber means is that the legislative intent must be clear in the statute itself.
That's correct. But and my point, Justice Sykes, is that that's never happened with wrongful death, because the assessment has always been, this is a statutory animal, so we can change it as we see fit. If it is a common law animal, an entirely new analysis must be permitted, and this court is in a unique position at this point to provide that analysis.
So the court needs to engage in that analysis, not the legislature, is your argument.
I see my time is up. May I?
Yes, thank you. Please.
This court has the power and the ability and is required to review the constitutional underpinnings of any statute passed by our legislature. And when the legislature revokes a common law right, this court needs to evaluate the due process, the equal protection, the right to jury elements of the revocation of that right.
Of course, that's the big argument, whether there was a common law right. I mean, that's the debate.
That is a debate. And I fully concede that some state courts have rejected Justice Harlan's rationale in the Moran case. But I direct the court, if I may, to the Massachusetts court in Gaudette v. Webb, the Illinois court in Wilbon versus D.F. Bast, the Alaska court in Hawkinson v. Wakefield, and the New Jersey court in Lafage v. Johnny, all accepting the prospect that a common law right to wrongful death damages existed in the United States.
Yeah, I have one more question before you skip away. If we look at the claim we have now, it's statutory, correct?
That's what we're faced with currently.
All right.
True.
And we look at the cap is statutory, correct?
The wrongful death cap, yes.
Okay. Now, if you persuade us that there is another claim that's common law, is it in addition to or in place of what's in the statute?
Our position, Your Honor, is that the statutory wrongful death, the wrongful death statute is appropriate in setting up the means or the basis for recovery of damages. Every state has a wrongful death statute. Only a few have caps. We're one of them. And it is our stance that it is the cap, the limiting, the revocation of a right, which is unconstitutional. And that is the portion of the statute which should not apply.
But, you know, if your argument is correct and underlying the statute is a common law claim that we haven't addressed previously, I don't know why the caps apply to the common law claim at all if it's all common law. I mean, I'm confused by your acceptance of a cap that's statutory, but you're asking us to conclude there is a common law claim that underlies the statute. Well, if the common law claim underlies the statute, why is there any cap at all that applies to it?
Perhaps I'm not understanding your question, Justice Brogan.
Yeah, well, it's maybe a little obscure. It's just bothering me.
But my thought is this. We are currently faced with a statutory cap.
Right.
Our position is the statutory cap is unconstitutional because the rationale behind that cap, and in fact the entire wrongful death statute, has always been that this was not a right that existed in common law, so the legislature can intervene as it sees fit. It is our position that such a right did exist in common law.
And so when they codified it, it didn't change that right, correct?
Exactly.
Okay, all right. But if they didn't change the right when they codified the claim, why is it they can change the recovery with the cap?
They shouldn't be able to.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get to. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Sager will argue on behalf of Dr. Hall relating to the cross appeal.
Correct. May it please the court, counsel, and guests. As the court knows, I was the trial lawyer that tried this case with Mr. Hind. Interestingly, the last time I was before the court was a year after I was graduated from law school in 1969, so I don't see any friendly faces. I see lots of friendly faces, but not old faces. Not old friendly faces. First of all, let's discuss the issue of the right to appeal. Of course, the remitter and editor cases began with Powers. After that, there was Plesko and Burmick and a host of others and Lucas, and they pretty well gave us the guidelines that we need to deal with that. And that is still the law. There's no change in that law. It's just that in this particular case, when the plaintiffs cross-appealed, they cross-appealed to issues that were unrelated to the factual determinations about damages that the jury had made. As you well know, the court reduced the jury's award of pain and suffering. That then puts the plaintiff in the position of being able to kind of have their cake and eat it too. And I have to sit up here and argue, which I will do, to explain to you why the court's decision was correct, but yet I can't say, and by the way, he should have reduced it some more. That's not appropriate in this situation, if I'm to be consistent with my argument. So I think the case law is quite clear. There has been no case, though, and I do agree that Plesko did not say this is to be done in cases only where there is an appeal on damages. However, all of the cases since Plesko do discuss and relate to cases where there has been a remitter and the party that's offended saying, well, that wasn't enough, I want some more, and then the other party says, oh, no, let's go back and reinstate the jury verdict. And I won't go through the list of cases that are there. You've seen them and I'm sure are familiar with them. So that's it. Basically, the Plesko case has been clarified by Lucas. It fully outlined what a trial judge is to do. There's really no determination that needs to be made by this court or any change of the law, but I do think a published decision indicating that it does mean when you have an appeal on a damages issue that you have the right to cross appeal and raise the issue in toto again. It does not apply to appeals where there are cases and issues raised on different subjects such as this one.
Mr. Sager,
yes,
going
Judge.
To what the judge actually did in
my
remitter,
next
slide. Do you agree that he gave very little reasons for remitter, or do you think reasons were set for it?
I disagree with that. I all due respect to Mr. End. The decision of the court was quite lengthy. In fact, he said something that I've seen in many published decisions where it says, hey, I was here, I was there. Something bothered me about this case, and I've seen several of the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court decisions where they say, we are going to give that judge some deference. In answer to your question specifically, when the jury verdict was retained, he paused and said, I need to consider question 8, which is the determination on pain and suffering. He said, since that observation, I've had to think about it a lot.
What page are you reading from so we can read along?
Pages 31, Your Honor, of the brief of the cross-appellant, the
okay.
blue-back page. He was kind enough to recite the court's decision in total. And I just read from page 30.
Right.
It says, when I got to question 8, I paused. I've had to think about it a lot. That's on page 31, middle of the sentence. I have 26 years of experience as a judge, as a lawyer, 9 as a judge, and have seen much over the years. Then he goes on to state at the bottom of the page, the limiting factor here is time. Okay? Then he goes on to state in the next page, this was a limited period of time in which this young child unfortunately had to endure conscious pain and suffering. And he repeats that again. And back to page 30, he said there was no acute distress in the early stages of this. So yes, Your Honor, he did. And in my opinion, he carefully reviewed all the things that he felt were necessary. Now, he didn't put in the negatives, which are there from the record. He did not say there was not one expert that testified to what kind of pain and suffering you can expect in this case. The plaintiffs had very qualified experts. We thought we did too. But there was no expert that testified this is what a patient would feel in a case like that. That's why this is so troubling. There was not one bit of evidence about that. Of course, the little girl was gone. But there was record evidence that showed, and I can't remember one time where it said she was crying, which would obviously be an objective manifestation of pain. Her mother explained the course of the disease process, and that's true. But the truth of it is that the actual severity of her injury and her process that led to her being comatose began right around midnight on the 6th, just before, and continued into the evening of the 7th, the early morning hours when she saw Dr. Hall, and then in the morning at 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock when she came back to the hospital to see Dr. Maddenberg. Then she went in the ambulance, became comatose, and died a day later. So we are really talking about a very compressed period of time, again, consistent with the court's decision saying, this is a short time. This child obviously did have some pain and suffering, but you know, I have 4 kids, and I my heart really does go out to the Morans. They lost a child. That's a terrible thing. But we see children with childhood illnesses, and as the record was presented, this could apply to this particular case.
Mr. Sager, how do you think we balance the right for remitter by the trial judge and the deference that's supposed to be given to the jury verdict? That's a tough thing, isn't it?
I think it is. There's no...
What factors should we...
There's no real standard. And the court, the decisions do give us some guidance. They defer to the court's personal observation. They defer to the court's review of the evidence and the court's being there. And I think that's an important thing. They look for record facts. They look for facts that are reasonable inferences from the record, the McCleary case that was cited. We're to look for, is this a rational analysis? Did the court consider this? And as you can tell, this judge struggled with this case and very, very carefully looked through those things. There isn't a cookbook, though. You're right. There isn't to say, you must do this, you must do that. The court is required to give a decision, and then we, the lawyers on the other side, are allowed to either support it or take little shots at it and say, didn't say this, didn't say that, and so forth. And the court does say, however, and there are several decisions by the learned court here that have said, you're not required to search one of several isolated pieces of testimony to support your decision. The court's decision in this case was lengthy, reasoned, and in my opinion appropriate, and I'm out of time.
And if we should disagree with you, do we go back and look at the record anew, or do we send it back to the trial court?
You're not supposed to do that unless you feel that the court, to go back and look at the record anew, unless you feel that the court abused its discretion in the first place and did not recite its reasons. So if the reasons are there, then it's an abuse of discretion question. Then you don't need to look at the record. Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll now hear from Mr. Larson, representing Dr. Hall, in rebuttal.
Well, I'm actually an attorney for the Patients'
Sorry.
Compensation Fund, but we're all
You're all together.
I am going to focus primarily on the stacking issue, but I did want to address your issue, your question with regard to the common law and statutory, the codification. I think one of the things that may get lost here is that Article 14, Section 13 gives the legislature the power to alter or abrogate a common law right. So, I mean, I think that trumps all this issue so that even if the court has been wrong for 150 years, which I don't believe it was, and there was a common law right, the fact is the legislature has the right and the power under the Constitution to change that. They have the right to codify a common law right and then limit what can be recovered under that common law right. Now, that may be subject to a constitutional scrutiny, but again, I think that's a rational basis test, and as this case, this court said in the Acre, Mr. Hiersman invited you to go back and do your own analysis of that, and my understanding is that's not how you approach it. You don't substitute your wisdom or judgment on that issue. You look to see whether the legislature exercised a proper rational judgment and basis for that, and that even if you came to a different conclusion, it's your obligation to sustain the constitutionality of that issue. Now, I want to go back to the cap issue, and first of all, I would disagree with one statement Mr. N made, that prior to June of 1986, he said that there was no cap on losses citing companionship in death cases. At least that's what I understood him to say. I don't believe that was true, because until the non-economic cap was enacted, there was no court in this state that was interpreting the statutes in a way that would mean the medical malpractice did not involve or apply the wrongful death limit on losses citing companionship. They all did. They all believed that 895.04 sub 4 applied in malpractice cases, and it was only that the Reinick decision did that change, and that decision was based on the fact that the cap was enacted, and that cap was enacted effective June 14th of 1986. Now, well, and what I was going to say is, in Reinick, this court invited or challenged, whatever way you want to look at it, the legislature, that if the legislature wanted this specific type of non-economic damage, it was already included within the definition of sub A that was in existence at the time of Reinick, but it challenged the legislature that if the legislature wanted the specific damage of loss of citing companionship in wrongful death cases to be subject to a lesser limit, which is the language this court used, then they should go ahead and specifically make a reference incorporating in the wrongful death statute of 895.04 sub 4, which is what the legislature did when it enacted sub F. At the same time, and I would challenge the argument on this.
Before you get to the next argument that you're challenging, let me ask my question.
Sure.
deals with your stacking or separate claims, which I understood you to be going to respond to. The facts here are that the parents are the beneficiaries of the state and also, of course, have standing to bring a wrongful death claim. But in a lot of cases, that may not be true. Given our Karpinski opinion that adult children do not have standing to bring a wrongful death claim, then I can see in situations where there are second marriages, third marriages, and the estate plan goes this way, that the adult kids are beneficiaries of the estate. But I'm going to take care of my second wife. She gets the house, she gets the property in Arizona, and of course, under the law, she would have standing, the kids wouldn't, to bring the wrongful death claim. So why are those separate and distinct claims? Because the kids certainly couldn't bring a wrongful death claim as adult children, but it's very common that the adult kids would be named as a beneficiary of the estate, but set aside other monies for the second wife. So why are there two claims here, given that rather common form of estate claim?
Well, I guess the argument there would be, you're right, it could be, but really what this cap is doing is not dictating where this money necessarily goes. What it's establishing here is the maximum cap on damages that can be recovered by the plaintiffs. Then it would be up to the plaintiffs, just like there was in the Keithley versus Keithley case where you had divorced parents who were fighting over the $50,000 loss of society and companionship claim. There can be an allocation, but that's not an allocation necessarily that the trial court and certainly that the defendants participate in or even involved in. So all I'm saying is that these caps, and in this particular case, there's no question because the loss of citing companionship cap is 150 and the non-economic total cap is 381 and some odd dollars, that there is still money to be awarded to an estate. And that is true in the case of an adult. You always do have an excess amount because right now that cap for loss assigning companionship is $350, and currently the non-economic cap is $42, and it's going to be higher next year, and it's going to be higher the year after that. And actually, at some point in time, the non-economic cap is going to exceed the cap on loss assigning companionship for a minor as well. And if the legislature saw fit to revisit that cap issue, too, then we'd have a different set of arguments there. So I think in that situation, if that's truly the case, there is a remedy that the plaintiffs can seek, just like the two competing parents did in the Keithley case, of trying to allocate the money under the caps, because the jury is not going to be told what the total non-economic cap is. I believe that's what the statute provides. So there is going to be a full award, and then it's going to be up to the judge in a separate process to determine which one gets reduced in what fashion. That does not affect the impact of a total cap being applied. It simply would set the cap, and then the allocation could be determined later.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. End, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. My rebuttal is to the reduction in damages award. And I actually last night sat down and read the testimony again, and you all have it. It's in our appendix. To answer the question you asked, Chief Justice Abrahamson, I believe that it's the obligation of this court to look, well, first of all, to determine whether there were adequate reasons set forth on the record by Judge Waddick in order for you to give him some deference. But your decision is to view the testimony in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. When I reviewed the records last night, and I think that Mr. Sager may not have, because he said to you, and I wrote it down, no expert testified about the pain and suffering that Shea Moran had. Well, here's what I found in the record. At page 119 of our appendix, Dr. Michael McDonald, who's the chief of the pediatric endocrinology at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, said, the body cannot store fuels. It's like a severe case of starvation. He told us how Shea was losing water in her urine. The salts were being pulled from her body. She was dehydrated. The food doesn't get to the muscles. The sodium and potassium were being drained out of her system. The fats were converted to ketone bodies and acids. And then he says, when acids build up, that's really bad news. That's really what makes somebody sick and start to have stomach aches, to vomit a lot, to breathe real fast, because our lungs are trying to get rid of the acids by blowing off CO2. He says, the pH of 6.96 means it's not fairly compatible with life for very long. It means the acids in the blood are really high. He said the level of the ketones were so high in her case that they were staying in her body, making her sick. He said this is clearly, and actually this was in his report, this is clearly one of the most severe cases of diabetic ketoacidosis ever to come to medical attention. Then he said it's the laboratory tests, and he says these indicate the patient was near death. And I asked him questions about the specific visits. He said she was lethargic from drinking a lot and urinating a lot. She felt weak from dehydration on March 5th. He said she was not eating well in the record, and that was from nausea from the buildup of acids in her body. It can cause severe stomach ache. He said the vomiting in the records of March 6th were related to the buildup of the ketones. She was having difficulty breathing. She was breathing fast and deep to try to blow off the CO2 to get rid of the acid. He said, and he also said, if the diagnosis had been made the night before by Dr. Hall, you could have given her fluids. She would have been fine. I thought this was important. Dr. Maidenberg, the doctor who saw her in the emergency room the last day, the visit of the 7th, he remembered her 3.5 years later when he got on the witness stand. And I asked him, how did you remember her? His answer was, I remember her because she was so ill. He testified he himself put the IV needles in because he was afraid she would die from dehydration. He estimated that she was 10% dehydrated by the time she got to the hospital. He said she was very, very ill. Her dehydration was life-threatening. Dr. Peter Chase, who heads the largest pediatric diabetic clinic in the United States, came in and testified about the whole line of events. I know I don't have a lot of time. He said she was vomiting because the urination had depleted the sodium and potassium in her system. Her peristalsis had stopped. She wasn't able to move her bowels. She was vomiting to get rid of the acids in her system. Mrs. Moran came in and testified about how Shay, on the night of the 6th, this is before she went to the hospital to see Dr. Hall, was vomiting, dry heaving, urinating all at the same time, standing up in the bathroom. She testified how she had to carry her daughter the morning of the 7th into her car because Shay didn't have the energy to stand up, how she had to carry her to the clinic, how she had to carry her to the hospital. And I believe that there is so much testimony about what this little 5-year-old girl went through. Mrs. Moran said in the hospital on that last day before she was transferred to Milwaukee, she said, "Shay was calling for me, and I said, 'I'll be right here, honey.'" The emergency room doctor, Dr. Maidenberg, said she could barely lift her head off the pillow. She gets put into an ambulance, and I don't know if you read this or not. Her mom said, I'll be following you. I love you, honey. Shay said, I love you too, Mama. And, I mean, this is a 5-year-old girl. I said to the jurors, use your good common sense. Be fair. That's all I said, and they were. And I'm asking this court to uphold a verdict that I believe was very fair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Howell, Mr. Larson, and Mr. End, and Mr. Harrisman, as well as Mr. Sager, for your arguments today. It is, I'm sure, a very painful case for all the people involved. We will now be in recess. Those who wish to leave may leave. We'll have others enter the courtroom. And our next attorney who is Attorney Adrian Moore, who is Assistant State Public Defender, will talk to you about the second case we're about to hear. We are in recess.